Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
What's up, Internet? This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I'm Kimberly Chow.
And I'm Amanda Dell. We are the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a festival about writing about eating.
We'll be talking to you today, as we do every day, live, not every day, every Tuesday, live at 2 p.m. out of the back of Roberta's at our home base here at Heritage Radio Network. Talking about what we are reading, watching, and listening to, as well as inviting on friends and family in and around the food and media worlds. We will be super, super hyped to be welcoming on later in the show Sierra Tischgart, senior editor of New York Magazine's Grub Street. But first, Amanda and I are going to chop it up about what we are reading, watching, and listening to.
Thanks. Yeah, I was excited to have a little bit of extra time over the past couple of days to get into some reading, had a nice train ride. So I dove into Michael Ruhlman's new book, Grocery.
Oh, nice. Michael Ruhlman, you mean Food Book Fair 2017 speaker and author?
Exactly. He was part of a salon at Food Book Fair 2017 talking about the past, present, and future of markets. And his newest book is called The Buying and Selling of Food in America. We may have briefly chatted about this on previous episodes of Recommended Reading, but I am mildly obsessed with grocery shopping. I think about it all the time. I go to multiple stores weekly if I can. I love shopping and cooking. So I was particularly excited to talk about and read this book, which I just started it, so I won't give the ending away, but it's not only, it's about the history of supermarkets and grocery stores, what we refer to as grocery stores in America. Mm-hmm. And then the latter part of the book will go into more about how as Americans our buying, eating habits have changed.
Mm. So where are you now?
I'm at the beginning, and it's talking a lot about the history of grocery stores. And what this book really did for me was made me realize grocery stores have not been the same forever. And thinking about the beginning versions of grocery stores and what the innovations are that led to the grocery store as we know it today. So I'll just read one part that kind of blew my mind. And also, as someone that's raised in the Northeast, I have never gone to this grocery store, but I've heard of it mostly because of one of my favorite movies, Fried Green Tomatoes.
This is a little bit of disclosure. Both Michael Ruhlman and I grew up in the Midwestern suburbs. So this sounds, I also began reading this book and it sounds very familiar.
Okay, because this is about a Southern chain called Piggly Wiggly.
Oh.
The Piggly Wiggly.
Take it away, Amanda. It says,
in 1916, in Memphis, Tennessee, Clarence Saunders opened a store he called Piggly Wiggly. His innovation was substantial: self-service. Before Piggly Wiggly, patrons of grocery stores were serviced by clerks. The customer read off a list of items and amounts, and the grocer weighed them out and set them on the counter, or used a contraption called a long arm to retrieve cans off high shelves. At Piggly Wiggly, one entered and exited through turnstiles, surely a decision based on the fear that customers could pilfer at will in this new kind of food market. Baskets slung over the arm and choose by hand from a variety of branded, packaged items. In 1929, Time magazine marveled at the almost automatic process of shopping there in an article called The Piggly Wiggly Man. So, wow. I mean,
Piggly Wiggly Man.
Just like every day, we just go into a store, pick something off the shelf, put it in our basket, pay, walk out, and that just wasn't the way things were done.
You don't even have to go through a turnstile now.
I mean, you can just order it from, you know,
the internet.
Amazon. I'll give Amazon their due shout out. But, you know, it's like, wow, it was considered revolutionary to go into a store and pick your own items up off of a shelf. Mm. So that's just kind of some of the history and insights that this book goes into, and it forced me to access, you know, a part of my brain to think about what, you know, it was like at the turn of the century in this country and you know, in the 1920s and 30s, and how much grocery shopping has changed.
Mm.
So I'm excited to keep reading. Kim, what about you? What are you watching or listening to or reading?
I'm very, very behind on issues of The New Yorker. This has been a running through line on our show, so I'm not going to bring this up again. I'll let you know if I ever catch up. So I've mostly been listening. We're really hyped today to be able to say that we've just released the recording of the keynote panel from Food Book Fair 2017 called What We Talk About When We Talk About Eating, with many food world luminaries moderated by Frank Bruni, talking about the business, pleasure, and politics of food today. And that's out now via Public Assemblies, Public Announcements podcast. You can find them at PA Pod. That's Public Announcement. Our friends Chris Black and James Ellis. So I've been listening to that and the insights therein. That podcast also includes a cut of our friend Jason Stewart, a.k.a. Them Jeans, interviewing different Food Book Fair guests and wonderful strangers and chefs and authors that came through the Ace Hotel lobby during our time at Food Book Fair. And you can see you can listen to the full thing on his food podcast, The Stew. But that's a nice sort of super cut of all the things that we like. So I've been listening to that. And then just because we don't always listen to food related stuff only or read about food related stuff only, I'd like to talk about what I've been listening to while I'm in the kitchen or while I'm eating or having my coffee in the morning. And I've been really inspired this past weekend by Everyday People, which is one of my favorite parties.
You know that that's one of my favorite parties.
It's the best looking party in New York City and the most fun. And the music is great. And the DJs are great. And they have an annual Memorial Day party with OK Africa. And it's called Everyday Afrique. And was at Output last night. And on the way there, after leading up to it, I've been listening to Dance Hall and Afrobeat. And went out to Lover's Rock a couple times this weekend as well, out in Bed-Stuy. Shout out to Lover's Rock. One of my favorite DJs who plays this party, DJ Moma.
Oh, yes.
I had found, I think it was through one of his playlists or on a Spotify Discover Weekly, I'd come across Omarion Distance, which it is now in my Hot 97 Top 40 trolling rotation. And now I just like play it while I'm on my bike or, you know, walking here or whatever. And it does kind of have to do with food because he does say in the chorus, I like my women like I like my chicken. But beyond that, it's a really catchy song, and I have no shame about that being the main media consumption I've undergone this weekend.
Well, we clearly are going to need to do a deep dive listen into this song, or I will, because I've only heard snippets of it. But I love hearing you talk about Hot 97, because it has to be one of the longest standing New York City based radio stations, because growing up in New York City, I remember listening to it as even a preteen. Mm-hmm. Hot 97, they had a morning show. This was like before, this is really dating myself, but this is like before, you know, iTunes, before you could really get music on demand. Sometimes we would record songs off of the radio, like
with
on
a cassette
player. And so that's like the Hot 90, that's a Hot 97 that I remember. So I'm going to have to retune in to Hot 97.
I was recording 89X alternative station in Metro Detroit. I definitely have a little bit of shame about that, but
well,
my tastes have changed.
Yeah. What were they? Was there any food at the Everyday People party?
There were boozy slushies.
Oh,
it's a Output rooftop summer Sunday special.
Did you?
There were French fries. I did not have the slushies. The line was very long outdoor slushie special. We did have a couple beers downstairs in the Panther Room.
Cool. We're gonna have to talk to Sierra about what she thinks about the frozen drink trend.
It's about time.
If it's going to take
off. 60 degrees today here in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, but it's almost that time.
Yeah, I see frosé happening a lot. I'm a little divided about it.
I think we'll talk about Top 40 as well, too, because I hear there's a hot new Carly Rae Jepsen cut, and we've got a couple other people in the studio that are also Top 40 listeners.
I feel like Carly Rae Jepsen would get down with some frosé.
She did a Grub Street diet. I don't remember if it comes up there.
Okay. Well, we'll have to talk to Sierra about that. Speaking of which, we'll be back with Sierra very, very soon. And we are going to get to talk to her about one of my favorite topics, the Grub Street diet, amongst other things. So again, thank you so much for listening. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. And what we need you to do in order to keep this show and hundreds of other amazing food radio shows on air is to head over to heritageradionetwork.org, click on that beating heart, become a member, check out all of the shows, come visit Roberta's, and then come visit Heritage Radio Network so you can see what it's all about. Again, it's heritageradionetwork.org. Visit.
Click on that beating heart. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting raps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hello, Internet.
Radio.
It's Kim and Amanda. We're going to cut to the feeling with Sierra Tischgart, senior editor of New York Magazine's Grub Street. We're going to talk to her about Carly Rae Jepsen, Grub Street diet, the minutia of the daily eating habits of notable New Yorkers, one of our favorite things. So get ready for that if you're not already obsessed with that. Hopefully you will Hopefully you won't stop listening. And we'll also talk to her about cookbooks she's cooking from, cookbooks and cookbook deals that she's writing about, and more. Sierra, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And thank you so much for, I'll just say a quick thank you off the bat for participating in Food Book Fair 2017.
Oh, that was fun.
Sierra was one of the editors that participated in Literary Speed Dating, an event we had during Food Book Fair 2017 where people got to pitch their ideas to you, which we want to talk about. But also we want to first start out with what you're reading, watching, or listening to lately. And whether that's cookbooks or other things.
Well, we can start with Carly Rae Jepsen, who just released a new jam.
Okay.
Not quite food related, but she did do a Grub Street Diet, and I think she's amazing. One, I just find her music so poppy and fun and happy, but I also like that she was pegged as a one-hit wonder and now has an album that has this really strong, loyal fan base and actually is, like, very critically acclaimed. Mm-hmm. And I like the feeling that she has transcended that. I mean, I'm sure, like you said, Call Me Maybe forever will be associated with that. But I like watching her thrive and succeed and not just be pegged to one thing. Isn't that, like, always kind of, like, the goal and the fear that you'll always just be known for one thing specifically?
Definitely. Yeah. As an artist, mm-hmm. you don't want to... Do you remember anything about her Grub Street Diet?
She was on tour during it.
Okay.
And, you know, the Grub Street Diet, I think, connects to so many people as a column in that it's about the food, but it's also not. It's really just how someone successful structures their life on a day-to-day basis and the choices they make. Some of them are certainly much more food-focused in the way people describe dishes in a very right. beautiful way. But also, it's just like, who do you spend time with? How do you make those decisions? How do you speak about time management? Because, you know, we do feature people at a certain level of success, and I'm very interested in that. So I remember for her, she was just hanging out with her band, eating pizza. She seemed wonderful. And I remember through the interview, she was very sweet and kind, but I can't remember what she ate specifically, but also kind of wasn't the point.
Okay, so we jumped ahead a little.
We can keep going.
We're just so excited to talk about Grub Street Diet.
And Carly Rae.
It's so nerdy of me, but it's my favorite thing.
The other things I'm reading and listening to, I just read The Red Parts by Maggie Nelson, which I loved. It's an account of her... She is observing the murder case decades later of her aunt. And I thought... As a journalist, it was such a good masterclass in writing in a way that puts yourself as the writer in a story, but also has larger observations about your subject. I just thought she was so self-aware of her own role in this, her own bias while covering this, while writing about it, her own family's history. There was just a real self-awareness that was all throughout the book about just the career as a journalist that really connected with me. So that was quite powerful.
Love Maggie Nelson. Have you read The Argonauts?
Yes. Bluettes is my favorite.
Bluettes is really, really good.
I read Bluettes all the time.
How did the book leave you in the end? Did you feel sad? Did you feel uplifted by it? Did you feel educated? What do you think about it as you were ending?
It's quite dark. It's much darker than most of the books that I read. So it left me feeling kind of rattled. I actually had to, like, put it down for about a month in the middle of reading it. So finishing it felt nice in that regard. So it left me feeling a little bit rattled, but definitely educated. Especially, you know, it was maybe written about like 5 or 10 years ago. It's not super recent, but even how it talked about gender and women's bodies and the way they're discussed in court felt like particularly interesting, especially right now, as I think there's so much more conversation about what it looks like to cover women and write about women and write about feminism. So that just connected with me from sort of a macro level of how you write about women, how you write about their bodies.
Mm.
It even relates to, like, you know, it's the back to food. It's the classic, like, every celebrity profile you read, them, how they describe what a woman looks like or what she eats. It's all, you know, the trope is like a model chowing down on a cheeseburger.
Right.
and just like how we write about women and their bodies and their connections to it. Something I'm always thinking about and try to be aware of in my work.
Do you remember a couple years ago, I think it was in the style section in the New York Times, they had a story, they had a full-length feature about that. And I think Jennifer Lawrence eating a burger and eating French fries was the archetypal documented, quote-unquote, documented instance of eating.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, I can't, and then you can never tell if it's performative or it's genuine, but it's become... It's a very strange thing. I also, of course, with the grub diet and all these things, I'm interested in what people are eating and want to hear about it. But it's sort of like, is that presented in a way that's sexualized? Mm-hmm. With Jennifer Lawrence, it was. It's very much like, look how beautiful I am chowing down this juicy burger. And, you know, it's kind of like, is there a gaze on that? Is that just genuinely who she is? It's mm-hmm. hard to tell sometimes.
We should talk about then the process of Grub Street Diet, because we... Not everybody. Hopefully we're not lifting the veil too far.
Yeah.
But as we understand, it is usually an interview that has been edited and condensed, not necessarily someone writing by hand or typing into their phone what they ate minute by minute, day by day.
Yes, it's very much a mix. I see the commenters always like this. They say like this writing's terrible or this or that. And it's like not. They didn't always write it. People are busy. I instruct every subject. I say take notes. The more thorough your notes are, the better. But we will flesh it out in an interview regardless, because I always like to go a little bit deeper and, you know, try to get more towards either it's more detail about what they ate. Some people are, you know, more detail-oriented than others, or it's just about, like, the emotional process of their week and what that felt like.
Mm. So you do read the comments?
Oh, yeah, I read the comments. I tell subjects not to read the comments. I'm convinced, I hope no commenters are listening, but I'm convinced we inherited the Gawker commenters because, like, they're so cruel. But, you know, it's how the internet goes, I guess.
Yep. I think almost everyone can relate to some sort of comment that's been made to them at you know, at one point or another on the internet, but glad to know you read the comments.
I do.
Returning to this idea of documented instances of eating or performative eating or what kind of gazes, plural, are applied, when you do the interview or when you get a subject's notes, what kind of questions come up in your mind? Or do you just sort of face it objectively as a journalist?
You know, I try to just have them, I don't know, that's an interesting question. Whenever I get their notes, you know, I'm often surprised, I guess. People think the most common thing with their grub diet is like people are making it up. And I actually really don't think that that happens. Of course, you know that you're doing it. We're not following around with like a hidden camera all week. Right. Like, you know that you're doing this. I like to actually get kind of meta and discuss with subjects the weirdness of that, of knowing that what you're eating is going to be public knowledge. Mm. And if that changes your behavior, I always like to include that. If someone's like, well, I knew I was doing this column, so maybe I did this, or it just felt weird, or it felt nice, or it motivated them to eat a certain way. But I don't think, one, people are lying. And if anything, I'm often surprised that people aren't a little more committed to eating interesting things or going a little more out of their way. Sometimes I get the notes and I'm like, really?
Like there was one I read a couple times. It was like the same breakfast every day, but it was like 7 days, and they're like, yep, it's the same breakfast. And like,
what breakfast was that?
It was like,
I remember,
cereal
this.
Maybe or something, you know, just very common or you know, or just what this person usually ate for breakfast. And despite them being asked to do a Grub Street diet, they didn't want to deviate from that. Mm-hmm. And we're just like, this is what I eat every day.
My life.
And it was great. It was actually great how it was printed. It didn't take up too much space, but it was just like, and the same breakfast. And again.
Surprise. Yeah. Same breakfast. I like when they do that. They're like, surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, I tell people, I'm like, be as genuine to your normal routine as possible. But, you know, also like you can have fun with it. You know, if there's a place that you really love, like go out of your way to maybe go there or just enjoy your week in a way that feels genuine to you, but also, you know, interesting. But I don't think people are, like, lying or making up what they eat. And our commenters are usually angry when it turns out to be someone who actually isn't that passionate about food. And I really do try to do my research and pick subjects that I think are funny and interested in this, but I don't know until I interview them the Wednesday or Thursday before it goes up on Friday. So it's a surprise to me too.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that is that's the turnaround for editing and writing. It's, you do the interview on Wednesday or Thursday, and then you release the diet on Friday.
Yes.
Okay. I'm hitting refresh at 10 a.m. on Friday. So,
8:30.
I mean, Sierra reports and writes about, you know, so many amazing things on Grub Street. So if you haven't checked it out, please do. But we specifically brought her on this show to talk about Grub Street diet because it's one of our favorite.
We've talked about it on other shows as well, and just also in general with other people. Between the two of us.
And it has to be one of the most long-standing columns, I guess, on Grub Street, right? Is that, I mean, it's, I went back to one in doing my research for this episode, and there was one that I really enjoyed, and I looked back and it was from 2010. And I was like, wow, I've been reading this for a long time.
Yes, we celebrated the 10-year anniversary last year.
Oh, I thought it was coming up, and I was like, oh my gosh, invite us to the party.
But we didn't have a party, which was such an oversight, but we had a couple of our, like, most loved subjects come back and do another one.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, so we had Bourdain come back. We had a week. We had two going up each day that week.
Oh, I remember that.
And it was fun. Though some people were like, it's too much. Like, you know, I get that. I was a reader before I started working at Grub Street. I would show up to my desk on Friday. I was working at Teen Vogue at the time, and it was, like, so exciting, and it was a nice way to kind of feel like I started the weekend. And then I inherited this and got to take it over, and it's been really fun.
It seems like it would be one of the most fun things that you can do. Speaking of fun, I thought maybe it would be fun if we talked about some of our favorite ones.
Speaking of this 2010 flashback. Yeah.
Well, I think even like a top favorite above that one, which we can get back to then, was really Garrett Oliver from the Brewmaster at our friends at Brooklyn Brewery. His made me laugh out loud and was so unrelatable in a couple of ways and so relatable in other ways. And anytime someone has never heard of Grub Street Diet, I'm just like, you have to read Garrett Oliver's.
Amanda, I remember Amanda texted me that Friday morning when it went up, and she texted me the link over iMessage. And I said, oh, I'll click on this when I have a second. And she says, you have to sit down. It's going to take you at least 11 minutes to get through the whole thing.
It is lengthy.
I tried to open it on my phone, and I was just like scrolling.
Here's I will just quickly read one of my favorite lines. It's not about the food, although the food is incredible. It's about Garrett's personality and just the fact that he wrote this down. This is the part that made me laugh out loud and was also, I think, also relatable for people living in New York. So again, this is Garrett Oliver, the brewmaster from Brooklyn Brewery, and this was from earlier this spring in March. Oh no. Oh my gosh. Technical difficulties.
Scrolling.
It's because it's so long, but you won't want to miss one word of it.
Shift F7.
You guys, it's going to be worth it. Okay, here we go. He says, I text a few friends. Want to come over for dinner? Nothing fancy. 7 o'clock? I wasn't getting serious. These were friends for whom you pick up your socks, but really only spot check the bathroom. What will I cook? I was like, oh my gosh, Garrett, that is just thinking about your friends in those categories. Like sometimes if you have someone coming over your apartment, you're like, oh my gosh, I really need to clean up. Like I'm going to make sure my bed's made. I'm going to make sure there's no weird stuff around. But then there's some friends that you're at a level of friendship with them where you're like, okay, come over for dinner. I'm going to cook whatever. And yeah, I'll make sure there's like nothing funky going on, you know, in the bathroom or anywhere else, and I'll maybe pick up my socks. But besides that, just come over. I was just, that had me on the floor.
Yeah, that was my favorite line too.
It's just getting that kind of, it's really like what you said earlier. It's about the food in some ways, but also just about getting insight into someone's life and how they think. So it's nuggets like that that will just always have me reading Grub Street Diet. Kim, are there any, not to put you on the spot, but are there any that you particularly remember.
I really liked one from, this is also like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, with Michael Lesconis, the pastry chef. He was at Le Bernardin at the time, and he and his wife celebrate Christmas with Brooks Headley. And there's also a snowstorm, so he gets 2 days off. So he's like, this isn't my usual diet, and this isn't usually what happens. And he writes about that. And he also talks about, his wife was also in the restaurant industry at the time, and he talks about how they would make dinner together every night, just like anybody else with their partner. Except their dinner happened to be at 2 a.m. after service. And that was how they kept their shit together, and that was important to them. And I really liked that. And it's just like, oh, chefs, they're just like us. Their schedule is just pushed 6 hours in a different direction.
Oh, wow. I'll have to revisit that one. I love
if you love ritual and routine, that will reward you.
Kind of. So Brooks is one of my favorites. He's just so funny. But my ultimate favorite is Samantha Bee's. So Garrett wrote his. This is like a perfect example of a mix. Like, he turned that in. He was like, oh, it's just, it's really long and it's kind of stream of consciousness. Like, I edit it. And I was like, this is amazing. You need, like, I mean, he has written about food pretty extensively, but I'm like, Garrett, like, you should be doing only, you could be doing only this and none of all of your other impressive jobs and be so successful at it. But Samantha, who's so funny, called me on the phone. You know, she was, I think she was at the Daily Show at the time, and she had 20 minutes, and she just said everything. You know, it was all from her just spitting it out. And she was so, so funny. Wyatt Cenac also did it this way. He's done it. He did it for the anniversary, so he's done it twice. But
his is really good.
Wait, sorry, who is it?
Wyatt Cenac. Oh, okay. He's a comedian.
Yes. Okay.
Both Daily Show people, which I guess is a testament to that show and that when they were both on it. But it is, I mean, it was just like coming out of their mind in like perfect comedic form. Like, I've never encountered someone who like just spits out jokes that funny and thoughtful and perfectly, just like, you know, on this side of the road. I think Samantha was calling me from. She was like driving somewhere. So that was like so cool and special. And I've just never heard someone experience someone think like that quickly.
And you don't think she pre-prepared at all?
I mean, I'm sure that, like, she might have had some talking points, but it did not feel like she was reading a script or anything. And Wyatt talked for, I think, like, over 2 hours.
Do you record?
I have a very nice group of interns who will transcribe it, but Wyatt talked and talked.
That's like a date.
Yeah. In some ways, I've done Corruption Night interviews that, like, feel very datey because it's, like, so intimate and there can go so long.
And right. And they're like, oh, well, I had someone over for dinner. And you're like, well, who was it?
Yeah. and Wyatt just talked for hours. He had so much to say about food and he had an exciting week. So, and if you read it, it seems like he wrote it just because the jokes are so tight and there's callbacks to them. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he put some, I would like to think he put some thought into it beforehand, but it was not like he was reading something off a page.
Or was he?
I don't know. I can ask Wyatt. I could text Wyatt.
Oh, you're on texting basis, girl.
I know.
It was?
No, it wasn't like that.
It wasn't a date.
Are there any subjects that you would like to have on Grub Street Diet that you have not yet had on?
Well, I was, Kiernan Shipka is like my, is, I've long been chasing. I was a huge Mad Men fan.
Yes.
And especially when I always really want a kid to do it. And she loves food. If you follow her on Instagram, she's in LA eating everywhere. And she's been like this for years. So I really wanted like young Sally Draper to do it.
Mm.
And I know, and like people have said she's interested, but like it just has never quite connected.
Okay, so she's on your target list.
She's on my target list. We were talking about Maggie Nelson and you brought that up. She would be incredible.
That would be awesome. It doesn't even matter what Maggie Nelson eats.
Yeah.
It's not about the food.
It's not about it. Susan Orlean did one, and she was long, like my white whale. She did one a couple years ago. And because she had written, you know, she's someone who's a great example of, like, not a food writer, quote unquote, but has written, her food has played a huge role in her work. She's written about her chickens. So I was excited for that one, and she did a great job. I think that's... Oh, and Tom Hanks. We were talking about this earlier.
Oh, yes.
Tom Hanks, if you're listening.
Tom Hanks. So Aparna, who was a wonderful comedian, did one recently, and then Tom Hanks tweeted it, like, this is so funny. And that was, like, I was mostly excited for Aparna, who is wonderful, and I think some people know, but is still somewhat up and coming, mm-hmm. and she had never met Tom Hanks before, so for her to, like, see that, she was like, this is the best thing of my life, and I felt excited for her in the column, and, yeah, Tom Hanks would be great.
Wow, I keep thinking, like, my mind goes to, like, what's Tom Hanks doing when he's reading Grub Street Diet? Is he, like, drinking coffee that he made himself? Is he having, like, a granola bar? Like, what, how does Tom Hanks...
How do we all consume Grub Street Diet?
Yeah,
those, like, of us who aren't hitting refresh on their computers. That
I kind of savor it a little Friday bit morning. Sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, oh, let me read a minute or two, then go back to my inbox. And then I'm like, oh, what did they do next? And then, yeah, I've read the comments, too. I just, you know, I think people are so brave to put themselves out there, to be honest, that, you know, if people are going to hate on them, that's, you know, that's their own insecurity is coming out. I think it's brave to put yourself out there and talk about something so personal.
New York Magazine's website and yes. and commenters. It seems to me, and I think there are some commenter overlap. There is some commenter overlap here. But reading, I used to be a long time sex diary reader. And there are a lot of commenters that also say, this isn't real. This is, like, collated from multiple weeks of experience. And there's a through line there with Grub Street Diet, that this couldn't possibly mm-hmm. all be in 1 week.
Sierra, do you read the sex diaries?
I do read the sex diaries. Okay. I read them every week, yeah. I know people with that one, those are all anonymous. Mm-hmm. So I think that maybe even creates more disbelief around it. But I don't know, it's like anything. Why, like, you, I can't, we're not running around, there's no way to properly fact check what every bite someone put in their body. But I, you know, you speak to them, you listen, you try to get a sense, and I believe, you know, you use your journalistic integrity to try to ensure that it's as accurate as possible.
Well, we can see that, and we will keep reading, and we will keep looking for that every week, Friday, in our inbox.
And if anyone listening has any suggestions, I love when people tell me who they would like to see. Except for when they're like, I'd like Mindy Kaling and all these people. I'm like, they are too hard to get. But, you know, but if there are any suggestions of people, and it doesn't have to be someone who's mega famous, even just someone like Garrett, who might not be a household name, but is, you know, has this very interesting job and is clearly so, so passionate about this.
Amazing. So should they tweet at you?
They can tweet at me. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Tweeting is good.
If you have a suggestion, you heard it here first on Recommended Reading, tweet at Sierra and your suggestion might end up as a Grub Street Diet.
I do have a question about someone who I would consider mega famous. Tony Danza.
Oh.
Who our friend Noah Fex, also a Food Book Fair 2017 participant, and multiple food book fairs, actually. Noah's the best. Noah shot him at Patsy's. We were supposed to have coffee earlier that day, and I was trying to move our coffee date. And he's like, I'm fine until 1 p.m., and I have to meet Tony Danza at Patsy's. I'm like, this is the best text I've gotten from anyone.
I love Noah.
Tony talks about eating two breadsticks and a banana every morning. Yeah. What kind of breadsticks are these? I need to know. Are they the big ones? Are they the skinny?
Talk about people I, like, shouldn't have saved in my phone. Because, like, was not like... Tony Danza was not like, here's my number, but I loved him so much. I was like, I'm just going to save this. And now every PR person is going to use a conference call when they set these up. But Tony Danza is in my phone. And I'm like, at some point, it will come in handy.
Did you text with him?
I think we do just to, like, find a time to talk. Just to be like, call me at this time for the interview. He was delightful. Like, I had walked away with just being like, what a dreamboat. And I was not a fan of his beforehand.
I could see him having that kind of personality.
Oh my God. I'm from Philadelphia, and he was going back that week to judge a talent show at Northeast High School, which is where my mom went. It's kind of a rough high school. And like, oh, just like Tony Danza. Just like, what a great guy.
Wow. One more technical question that you...
But we don't know what kind of breadsticks.
Right.
No, but maybe we should prank call him after this.
Oh my gosh. Let's text him right after this show. And we're like, what kind of breadsticks did you have this morning? We need to know.
You can't see, you can't hear me biting my lip right now.
But Kim wants to do it. Speaking of the photos and NoFX and Melissa Hom and Liz Clayman, some other amazing talented photographers that photograph for Grub Street, who gets to choose where, does the subject get to choose where they get their photo taken? And are there any parameters, Sepa, you or anyone else, about where the photo is?
The subject gets to choose.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They often give, like, I mean, I let them pick, but they often are like, maybe here's two places I like. And so I chime in, especially if I feel like we've shot at a place, like for Russ and Daughter's Cafe, we shot there many, many times. So I'm sometimes like, oh, we just did this. But they get to pick, and we'll meet them there. It can't be their own restaurant if they're a chef, a restaurateur. It has to be someplace else.
Okay. And then I guess this doesn't mean there. You never would not shoot it at a restaurant or cafe or like coffee place or like. Is there?
We much prefer to shoot it. I think we shot Taron Killam in his SNL dressing room. If it's really like a tight matter of time, but I always say pick a restaurant or cafe that you like.
Okay. Well. It's only Tuesday, but I can't wait for Friday to see what's going to happen. I know you won't give us any.
I want to say it, but I'm not. I should. I'll tell you after.
We're going to love it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that'll be.
I think so, but see, like, I don't know yet. That's the thing. Like, I even, you know, I'll find out Wednesday afternoon.
Okay. Sounds good. As much as we could talk about Grub Street Diet forever. Sierra's actually also working on something else that is of interest to hopefully our listeners.
And as we are
Food Book Fair. Talking about, she's currently researching an article about cookbook deals for smaller restaurants. And I know we can't talk about it too much, but would love to share maybe what got you interested in that and what you're hoping to uncover.
Yes. So Nick Kokonis, who is the owner of Alinea and the Aviary, wrote a Medium post recently that I found really interesting about how cookbook deals are structured and both the lack of transparency and often lack of money surrounding cookbooks. We're seeing, it seems like, you know, from outside, the industry's booming. There's so many beautiful, wonderful cookbooks coming out at the time. But his post touched on the way advances are structured in that you get all this money up front, but then you're actually depleting it to create the book. And if you're if you're anyone, you can often end up actually in the red for a cookbook. And also that there's not a lot of readily available information about the cost that it takes to actually make a book or for the publishing house to produce it, and also even how many cookbooks someone is selling. So I found this really interesting and inspiring, and was thinking about how we cover cookbooks, which is really just often the batch of the brand shiny new ones, and what has happened to some of the cookbooks that are a few years older, especially the impact specifically on smaller restaurants, you know, not necessarily like the Shake Shack cookbook, places like Salty and Fat Rice that are more independent operations but have written cookbooks, and how they manage that financially and if they felt like they were empowered throughout the process. So I've been talking to a lot of chefs about what it was like for them, if they would do this again, and really taking, you know, sort of a step back at what is the cookbook process like for these people a few years down the road, then maybe even, I'm trying to get a few people who are even like a decade out, and did they end up making money? Did they end up feeling like if they didn't, the benefits were still valuable to them artistically or whether through PR?
Mm. Wow. And has the community been open and receptive to talking to you about that? And was anyone scared to talk about it?
I'm still finding it's funny to be talking about a story that I'm still writing, but I'm happy. Yeah. But I'm happy to. The toughest thing, I think, and this is not just with this story, but with many stories, is that people are nervous to talk about money.
Right.
They always are. Mm. I understand it, but I think that Nick is really great about that. I did a story about a month ago on these very ambitious international restaurant pop-ups, like Noma in Tulum and Alinea going to Madrid, and, you know, these like things that seem really flashy and sexy and are so expensive, but how the restaurants actually fare. And so Nick was even quite honest and was like, when we took Alinea to Madrid, we lost money, even though they're charging like $600 a head. So getting people to talk money is always the hardest part, and it's important for this story. And it's awkward for me to be like, how much was your advance? Did you think that was fair? But it's a little bit of a domino effect that a couple people start doing it and you know, other people feel more encouraged to follow suit.
Yeah. So Nick spoke a lot about self-publishing, right? I mean, that's what they're planning on doing. Do you think that that's something that we'll be seeing more of? Do you think that chefs and authors feel that they want to go a more traditional route and, you know, link up with a publisher?
I think we definitely could see more self-publishing. I think some chefs are surprised by the amount of freedom and control that sometimes that they actually, the publisher then hands to them. In some ways, it's really nice because it is freedom, but they're a first-time cookbook writer, suddenly they're like, oh, I need to figure out the designer and the photographer and the writer, and I'm responsible for all of those decisions anyway. Perhaps it's not such a big next step just to totally self-publish. So I think we could potentially be seeing more of that. What I'd actually really like to see is cookbooks in different formats. I spoke to one person who was a little bit early in creating an iPad app for a cookbook, but we were just talking. I love watching videos of cooking. I feel like I'm still have a lot to learn as a home cook, and when Melissa Clark has a little video and she shows me how to perfectly roast that chicken, that's so immensely helpful to me. And the barrier I face with a lot of cookbooks is that I'm looking at this complicated recipe. I know it's going to be expensive and time-consuming to run on by all the ingredients. I want to at least feel like someone is a little bit holding my hand along the way, or that it's at least been tested properly, which is always a little bit of a gamble. So I love videos, and I would love to see people with cookbooks get a little more dynamic in that way.
That's super interesting. I never really watch cooking videos. Kim, do you watch cooking videos?
I don't watch a lot of cooking videos. I don't really have the patience. I don't even have the patience for the video to load and buffer and to get that past the ads. But that's just me, because I read a lot faster than I watch something in real time. But that might just be a personal preference.
Yeah. So maybe in the wave of the future is like a multimedia cookbook that somehow.
Remember, that's what Lucky Peach started out. It was supposed to be a video iPad. Oh. It was supposed to be a video-driven iPad experience and then a print magazine, and they were going to go together. And I actually wrote a story about this when I was a journalist for the Wall Street Journal 6 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Except now I no longer have a subscription and can't unlock that story and tell you what it's about. It's like, we tried really hard a couple months ago.
We're always trying to send each other stories from the Wall Street Journal. I'm like, don't you have the key, the password? Can we just buy one?
Lifetime subscription.
If the Wall Street Journal is listening, please give us a subscription so that we can access the digital
shout
articles.
You out on the show every week. But that was the idea, that it would be, you would have your print content and you would have recipes in there. The magazine has obvious. I'm still trying to figure out whether to speak about it in past or present tense. It has recipes as well as reportage, and then the video was going to be narrative, and some of it was experiential, and some of it was going to show you how to make. For example, I spent after hours filming in the Mapesh kitchen with David Chang and Sean Brock, making different versions of a turkey sandwich called the hot brown, hot turkey experience, really.
I've heard the story. When you say after hours, this is pretty late.
This is like 1 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Is that
maybe 4 a.m.?
Is that the perfect time for a turkey sandwich?
It's the time when you run a restaurant full time or multiple restaurants, and that's the time you got.
Wow. So maybe in some way, shape,
shout
or
out
form,
to that Midtown Life 2011.
In some way, shape, or form, maybe there'll be a resurgence of a multimedia experience. Maybe that's something that the user really wants and can benefit from.
Well, we've also talked about, and we were talking about this earlier before we kicked off the show today, about reading cookbooks not for recipes and not to cook out of them, but for quote-unquote huggability.
Right.
Shout out to JJ Good.
That's such a good way to phrase it.
Today is just such an overcast day. Tonight I might just get into bed with one of my favorite cookbooks. Not to leave us on that, I do see our amazing engineer, David Tadisher, giving us a knowing look. But maybe Sierra would honor us by leaving us with a Tish Garden update. Oh. Tish Garden, if you don't know and you don't follow Sierra on Instagram, which you should, is her beautiful garden. I'm jealous of it. And she gives updates, but I'm excited to get on Instagram, but I'm on Instagram stories mostly. I'm excited to get a live update right now about what's going on in Tish Garden.
Oh, yeah. So my apartment is like 80% garden. It's like the most impractical thing in New York. And when I got it, I like barely knew how to grow a plant. So it's been this really wonderful like crash course in gardening. And I still am like just like doing it as I go along and figuring it out. And I just planted a bunch. I planted a lot more vegetables this year, fruits and vegetables, which I'd always done herbs and flowers. And squirrels have forever attacked my tomatoes. So now I'm dealing with like a caging situation. But I have eggplant growing, a blueberry bush that looks fantastic, that I really think is going to come through for me, and a little strawberry plant that the chef at Olmsted very kindly sent me. So I'm like really unsure of what's going to happen with the fruits and vegetables. But it'd be nice to have more of an edible garden. So that's very exciting. And then I planted a peony bush 3 years ago, and not even a bush, a peony bulb. And like, you know, dug into the ground, put the bulb in, never saw a peony. And then 3 years later, there was a single peony in the garden.
Wow.
So that has been like...
That's very exciting.
Extremely exciting.
And I love peonies. It's like this beautiful big one. And it's, I just like, it's kind of, I hate this word, but it's like sort of magical. Like why 3 years later did I get one peony? I probably planted like five or six bulbs. So that's been really exciting and wonderful, and I'm glad that you are watching along.
I'm living my garden dreams.
Yeah.
Through you. Again, Sierra Tishgard, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being a participant in Food Book Fair.
Yes.
And for being on Recommended Reading. And we will look forward to our Friday inbox amongst other Grub Street articles soon to come.
And listeners, we will be back here next Tuesday at 2 p.m. for more. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, David. David Tatasciore, our engineer.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.